international loan finance. We are looking at the euro loan market. We want to understand the nature of the different facilities that we can reapply, reuse, the basic core standard term loan documentation that we're going to cover. We can see how this is reused in a large number of other core facilities across the financial system. We're going to look at loan structures. We're going to look at issue procedure, the nature of syndication, specifically the relationship between the syndicate banks that make up the syndicate group. We'll also mention lead bank and agent bank liability. I have a separate paper on this which looks at this in further detail, but we can highlight some of the key points now. We're also going to look at loan conditions and obligations. In practice, we need to look at the conditions precedent, the CPs. We need to look at the representations and warranties, reps and Ws, and we need to look at the covenants or the cups. These are the three core sets of conditions. If we understand how these work, we'll understand how the rest of the deal fits together. And then we're going to look at the defaults. There's three key sets of provisions: the financials, the obligations, and the defaults. The financials are in the loan structures, principal, term, interest, repayment, and then drawdown, repayment, and obligation. Then the obligations, and then the defaults. Three key sets of provisions. What simply happens is this: there are only a certain number of ways we can draft these provisions, we can prepare these clauses. If you can understand a perfect set of standard documentation, very well high standard drafted documentation, you can handle and manage any deal, any transaction. What will happen is you will come across new deals in practice. We'll have different parties, different names, different whatever. It doesn't matter. The actual content is always the same. You've got the financials, you've got the obligations, and you've got the defaults. And if you know that, you understand everything, even before you've started to look at a facility. It doesn't matter whether it's 100 pages or 1,000 pages, or it's a box, or it's five boxes, it doesn't matter. That's the deal. And if you know that, you know where to go straight away to confirm all the key terms. I'm going to go straight for the what's the amount, what's the term, what's the interest, what's the drawdown, what's the repayment, what are the obligations. Within each of the obligations, I know the key clauses that should be there, which means if something's missing, I'll spot it, and if something's there which is badly drafted or is too strict for my client, I know what to negotiate on. So very quickly, so long as you understand the basic core structure for any transaction, any deal, you'll be able to, you know in advance what should be in the documentation, so you know how to manage, how to deal with this, and how to advise your clients. So we look at the core financials, we look at the obligations, we look at the defaults, we'll then look at the default remedies, and we'll highlight these, and then we will come on and look in further detail at transfers. Historically, we could not transfer personal debt obligations, and debtors who couldn't repay used to go to things like debtors' prisons, and there was difficulties in law in transferring personal debt obligations. We then developed various forms of legal assignment and equitable assignment, which are now codified in what we refer to as the Law of Property Act 1925, section 136, which is all dealt with in detail in the chapter with relevant case law. But the key point is this: you can only assign benefits, rights and benefits. You cannot assign obligations. So if you're transferring obligations, you have to have a novation. So if we're bringing in a new bank, for example, and we want to transfer our obligations to the new bank so that we can leave the transaction, it has to be a novation. And what we'll see is in different types of documents, you have transfer instruments, and we'll look at the various market terms that we can use, but you need to see, is this actually technically an assignment or is it a novation? Very often you have to be careful about this because you can only assign benefits, you cannot assign obligations. If you want to transfer your obligations, it has to be a novation. Although there are other devices that we can look at, participation, sub-participation. Some people talk about trust, although it's not technically a transfer, it's creating an alternative interest. And then securitization, where we can convert one type of lending into another type of lending. We'll also mention if anything goes wrong, the borrower cannot repay, whether it's a government or a large corporate borrower, we need some form of rescheduling, or restructuring, we need to look at the various terms that would apply in those cases. Specifically, we have two clubs. We have the Paris Club and the London Club. Paris Club was set up in 1956. The London Club, slightly later, not quite as formal. But what we can do is this. When we have complex renegotiations to be conducted, very often with sovereigns, but also with borrowers, with corporate borrowers, we can use these clubs to assist us. Mainly the Paris Club for sovereigns. If other countries are in particular difficulty, we can also use International Monetary Fund support or World Bank facilities. They specifically have what they call a heavily indebted poor country facility, a HIPIC, which we can also use to write off debt in particular cases. So, with all of this, we can understand how this large, complex market has grown and evolved over time. We're then looking at traditional forms of term lending. The core function of banks is to accept deposits. The banks then pool those deposits and on-lend them. That creates a form of maturity mismatch, a form of maturity transformation. The art of banking is managing those two obligations, or those two sets of relationships. The banks funding themselves, short, on-site, and then lending medium to long-term. The banks have to manage their liabilities and their assets. The loans are the assets because those generate the income and that provides the bank with the profits. The liabilities are the source of funds. This could either be the deposits or it could be the interbank markets. In these international transactions that we're looking at, we're going to draw down the funds not from the deposit base but from the interbank markets, but it's the same situation. When the banks are drawing down in the markets, they are the debtor, the other banks lending, and the interbank markets are the creditor. When the banks then on-lend, they become the creditor and the borrower is the debtor. So there's two sets of debt obligations. Just have to make sure we're clear about that. In these specific markets, a lot of it is based on the interbank markets, which support the euro-dollar markets. So the funding won't actually come from deposit base, it's going to come from the interbank markets themselves. So we need to understand the nature of the euro-dollar markets in these terms. These markets grew and expanded very quickly in the post-war period, in particular during the late 1950s, early 1960s. We had the massive expansion of first the syndicated lending market on the basis of the earlier placement market or deposit market, which supported the interbank market. And then after that, we also had the development of the euro bond market. The bond market began in 1963 with the S.G. Warburg deal for Autostrade. Autostrade built the motorway system in North Italy. We'll come back and look at all of that in further detail. The core term loan can then be used in different types of facilities. I've mentioned in this introductory section, we have, for example, bilateral or direct loans, that's non-syndicated loans. And then we have syndicated, bank or participated loans. We can also have different other facilities you'll see there. We can have multi-currency facilities, multi-purpose facilities. We have committed facilities. That means that the bank's under an obligation to make the funds. If it's uncommitted, the bank has the discretion to lend, but it doesn't have to. We can have participated or blind participations. That's when the borrower knows or is informed that a bank is there. If the borrower doesn't know that, it's a blind participation. So, for example, one bank may be lending to the borrower, but those funds are coming from another bank. That could be a direct or bilateral non-syndicated facility, but we can also have that in a larger syndicated structure as well. We can have other guide facilities, which is similar to a non-committed facility. The banks will make funds available, but there's no specific obligation. So it's like sort of, there's a discretion, sort of a guidance, a sort of like outline as to what might be made available. We can have back-to-back or parallel loans. These were important and useful in the 1950s. What very often could happen is this. There's one of two ways we can do it. A company in one country can borrow on identical terms from the banks in that country, and then we create a parallel facility, identical facility, in another country using another borrower with another bank. but they tie the two facilities together. So we can get parallel loans across jurisdictions. What we can also do is, in the same country, we can lend to one bank, or one bank can borrow on behalf of one parent bank can lend to one subsidiary, and then the other parent bank of that subsidiary lends to the subsidiary of the first bank. There's different crossovers, different types of parallel structures we can use. It means that we can benefit from different interest rates, different costs of funding in different financial centres. That's what this is for. Principally, it's a form of hedging, but there may be other benefits that can arise in particular cases that the specific countries would need that type of facility. But you can either get these different parallel facilities in different financial centres, or we can get cross facilities in the same financial centre. We've also got this idea of transfer. While loans were inherently non-transferable historically, we've developed a secondary market in loans subsequently. The specific devices include, as we've already mentioned, either assignment, legal or equitable, under section 136 of the Law of Property Act 1925, or a novation. We novate obligations, we assign transfer benefits. We actually develop a specific market to support this, called what we have transferable loans instruments, TLIs, and transferable loan certificates, or transferable participation certificates, TPCs. TLIs are essentially assignments, TPCs are novations. And what we'll actually do is this, we attach a form of assignment or novation at the back of the loan agreement, so any of the banks can simply execute this and then transfer the facility. But we can then create a secondary market in these. It's equivalent to a bond market, to a note market, where we buy and sell securities, but we're effectively buying and selling loan participations. We can principally do that through forms of TLIs and TLCs. It's a secondary market in bank participations. The first form is an assignment, the second form is a novation. We've also got, as we've mentioned already, we can incorporate these terms into any form of larger structure. In practice, we often refer to these as MOFs, multi-option facilities, or multi-option funding facilities, which can include a range of other specific types of facilities, which may include a credit element. Very often these will be based on bonds or notes, short bonds or notes, but we can also include money market and other credit instruments as well. I provide a short summary of the historical development and emergence of the loan market up until the Eurodollar period in the post-World War era, with the beginnings of the Eurobond market, 1950s, 1960s, massive expansion, 1970s, 1980s. All of that summarised in the text, both with regards to the loan market, the placement market, and with regard to the bond market. These term loan facilities that we're referring to, we can use in almost any type of other credit or banking relationship or arrangement. This is why the term loan is of such importance. It's used across the financial system. And if you understand the basic structure and content of a standard term loan, you will understand almost any other type of financial document, because basically it's all based on this, and we'll just have various other ancillary clauses built around that. We can use these term facilities in the euro loan market for multi-purpose and multi-currency facilities. Very often, the loans that we'll be looking at, the large, open, syndicated term loans, do not have a purpose limit. Very often, there'll be no purpose clause. There is drafting for a purpose clause, but there'll be no purpose specified. So that the borrowers, whether it's sovereign or corporate, can draw down for almost any purpose. In the standard euro loan deals, there's no purpose restriction. If we're looking at this in relation to, for example, a project finance deal, there will be a specification. The loan has to be used for this particular purpose, and all of that will then be explained and expanded in the information memorandum, which supports the explanation as to the business of the borrowers, the use and purpose of the funds, and the source of repayments. This will usually be multi-currency as well. You will be able to draw down in a principal currency, but the borrowers will usually have complete freedom to draw down in almost any other available currency in the international financial system. The principal advantage of these facilities, these documents, these structures, is that they provide maximum flexibility to the borrower and to the banks. The borrowers can draw down in any currencies, any amounts, for different periods, in different financial centres, in different currencies. They have full flexibility. You can run a global business using this. This is what these things are for. And if, for example, the value of one currency drops against another, you simply switch from one interest term, and that might be 3 months or it might be 1 month, to another currency. So you can borrow much better, much more attractive rates in another currency, in another financial centre. You can transfer things around. There's an enormous amount of flexibility that we can have in these documents. It's why the standard term loan is still such a valuable core funding credit facility. We can have term and revolving facilities. Terms are for specific durations. Revolvers, you repay back and draw down again. It's the same as an overdraft, although in commercial business finance areas, if we provide a revolving facility for a company, we'll call it a credit line. We don't call it an overdraft, it's a credit line. But we will have very often a revolver incorporated into these facilities with the A and the B. The typical A under the standard loan market association, multi-currency term loan, will have the A facility is for a fixed duration, possibly 20 years, but the revolver will be repaid over whatever the borrower specifies as the repayment period, which will correspond with the drawdown period. So it might be 3 months or every month. And then we can close that or we can have that open. So if it's a 20-year facility, you will draw down under the term loan for possibly up to 1 or 2 years under the drawdown period, but the revolver may be open for 10 or even the full 20 years. So the borrowers can draw down, use, repay, and then draw down again. With the term loan, when you repay, you cannot draw down again. What's the difference? Why would you have this? In practice, if, for example, the country or the company wants to buy land, it wants to build something, it wants to purchase something, the main purchase costs you would use the term loan for, but for other working capital purposes, day-to-day running costs, you would use the revolver. And this is what will happen in practice. A client will come to you, or you'll be acting for the lead bank, and you'll be sitting in the meeting, and the client explains, I need funds for this, and this. So what you have to work out is what fits the different types of facilities that will be available. You want a term loan for that, we can have a term loan with a revolver attached for that, then we can look at a long bond for that, we can look at a medium-term note for that, we can look at short commercial paper for that. Commercial paper, we can go from 12 months down to 6, 9, 3, 5 days. With all of this, we can also support it with a credit line, or we can also build in derivatives later. We can have currency swaps, interest rate swaps. We can have what's called a swing line facility, which gives you temporary funds to transfer from one lending option to another lending option. There's all sorts of different things we can do. We can create maximum flexibility in these systems. Your function, your responsibility is to understand how all of these works so that you can advise the client to be able to draw down most effectively. So I've also mentioned credit lines. We can also use this in asset or property finance. I've specifically summarized key types of deals for purchasing aircraft and for purchasing ships. All of this can be based on a term loan. In almost all of these cases, we're going to use extra companies of some form. Well, maybe a lessor company will be set up to purchase. Very often, if it's an airplane, an aircraft, you'll have a lease finance deal for the fuselage, and then each of the engines, because they're so valuable and they cost so much, they have their own separate lease finance deals. And then with ships, you'll register the ship in a specific flag of convenience state, and then the lending can be carried out through them. But again, we can either use bond markets, capital markets, or we can use syndicated lending for that as well. Project finance, these large complex deals to build anything from power stations to nuclear reactors to desalination plants, any of this, the core funding could either be a syndicated loan or it could be a bond or a note program. Or it could be both. And we can look at different structures. Acquisition finance, again, if you're buying companies, very often there'll be some form of debt offer, some form of debt issuance, but again, very often you'll want a basic loan somewhere in the deal to provide the core lending
facilities available. So I summarised some of the basic structures there. In a lot of transactions, what we're trying to manage is this. It's the repayment hierarchy. It's the repayment priorities. We do that in terms of subordination. So the different borrowers, different creditors, will then be postponed against each other. And you need to be able to understand this in these very large complex deals. You have a large number of creditors, which will include the direct lenders, as well as the investors in the capital markets, as well as, for example, the government and the tax authorities and local authorities, and they all have different payment entitlements, they all have different payment priorities. A lot of this will be controlled through the documentation, a lot of it is managed by separate statutory entitlements. And then, in particular with these acquisition finance deals, you see some very complex structures. But what you're doing is you're actually creating companies within large acquisition structures to create what we call structural subordination. So there's multiple tiers of companies created within these large acquisition structures just so that there's different payment waterfalls created. And you can see massive flexibility, maximum possible use of funding and available options in all of these structures. I then look at the core structures in more detail. These are the key financial terms. We can understand this in terms of basically understanding the core provisions which will be in any type of credit facility. So this is the banking market. And remember, the banking market is the wider market for the advance of funds, of loans, either on a single direct bilateral or a multilateral basis. We also have what we call the money markets, which are the narrower, smaller group of wholesale markets, usually up to 1 year with professional counterparties. And all of this is dealt with separately in the documentation provided. With regards to the key financial provisions, we have the principal amount, we have the term, we have the principal amount that's going to be advanced for the term. We need to know what that figure is. What the banks basically do is this. Banks undertake a credit assessment. They need to have enough information at the beginning to determine whether they want to lend, how much they want to lend, and then depending upon the risk, at what cost, which is the interest rate. The banks need that up front. That will principally be provided in these deals because the banks very often don't have direct access to the borrower. And certainly all the borrowers' companies, all the borrowers, all the different companies which make up the borrowers' group. So that's going to be provided through the information memorandum. And the lead bank needs to ensure that all of this information is available. What they're trying to do is this. Each bank in the syndicate is legally responsible for making its own independent credit assessment. Do I lend? How much do I lend? At what cost? That's then reflected in the final documentation. What the lead bank's going to do is coordinate all of this to ensure that we can get, hopefully, as common conversion terms as possible. We're going to want a single interest rate, usually that's a single margin, single profit payment. If it's floating, it'll be based on the local interbank offered rate, IBOR, and then we'll have a fixed margin, the fixed profit. The banks will then have choice only usually with regards to the proportion that they make up. In our example, 10 banks, one principal borrowers, three subsidiaries, 10 borrowers, 10 banks. We can assume 100 million, each bank puts up 10 million. When each bank is undertaking its own credit assessment, it will determine how much do I want to lend. Do I want to lend 2 million, 4 million, 5 million, or 10? So this is all part of the bank's own individual credit assessment. But legally and commercially, the banks are responsible for that themselves. And this will be reflected in the documentation. The documentation will specifically state that. Each syndicate member, each lender, will undertake its own credit assessment and that the lead bank will have no duty to advise or report or any liability in this regard of any form. So we have to determine the amount and then allocate the proportions across the banks. Term, because these are for very large amounts, the term tends to be longer. If you're going to borrow 100 million, you don't want to borrow 100 million on 10 days, 3 months. Usually it will be 20 years. It can be 30, 40, or 50. Large international organisations, institutions like the World Bank, they will lend 50 years. Most banks typically 20. Shorter loans, 10 years. Typical syndicated lending anything between 10 and 20 years. Interest, as we've said already, fixed or floating. Earlier facilities were generally fixed, but because of the instability in the international financial markets with the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, which occurred essentially after President Richard Nixon announced the closure of the gold window that supported the dollar exchange system. That was on 15th August 1971. We've essentially moved on to floating currencies since then. So we have massive volatility in currencies and also associated massive volatility in interest rates. That's when a lot of the new interest rate instruments came into operation, including what we call floating rate notes, FRNs. Most of the early lending was either done on a syndicated loan basis, fixed rate, or on a bond basis, fixed rate. And legally, a bond means it's fixed. If it's a note, it's floating. So we had developed these floating rate notes, FRNs, beginning of the 1970s. Why? Just after the new risk that was created because of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. If it's floating, we look at the local interbank offered rate, the IBOR. It used to be the London interbank offered rate, but we've now replaced that. London interbank offered rate had basically, it operated on the basis of 16 to 18 of the largest banks in the City of London reporting figures that they expected to be charged to borrow overnight on an unsecured basis at 11 o'clock every morning. That was reported to the British Bankers Association, the BBA. There was either 16 or 18 of these figures. We take off the top four and the bottom four, and we average the middle. We average the rest. That's how we calculated the rate. The problem was it was done on an estimate basis. And in those days, everybody trusted everybody. But since the global financial crisis, nobody trusts anybody. So the trust that was in the system before collapsed, mainly because one institution had slightly overstated its figures and then admitted that to the regulators and to the market, which was Barclays Bank. For that reason, we've reformed all of this, and we now have local IBORs, interbank offered rates, in each of the main financial centres, including specifically SONIA, the sterling overnight rate in London, ESTER or EONIA in Europe, and then we have IFOR in New York, and we have TIBOR, we have HIBOR in various other financial centres. The main thing now is this: SONIA operates on the basis not of estimates but of banks' actual costs. It's their actual borrowing costs for the previous evening from it's what they would charge between, I think it's 6 o'clock and midnight, 6 o'clock the following day, what you would have to pay on an overnight basis, on an unsecured overnight basis, for that specific day. So you now report the actual figure. So there's no discretion, there's no element, there's no possible abuse, there's no possible inaccuracy or any difficulty that could arise. You're reporting actual figures. So now the London rate is SONIA. Repayment and drawdown, again, we can draw down in one amount and we can repay in one amount, or we can do it in tranches, we can create maximum flexibility. And the borrowers will be given that. And again, that's why these things are so useful as credit instruments, because the borrowers have maximum flexibility. And they can change this as well. So if you're borrowing 100 million, there's so many different ways you can structure that in terms of the drawdowns or for the different bits of the group, and then for the different interest periods and for the different currencies. There's so much flexibility you can have. All you simply do is tie that to your own business and your own business and development and growth over the following 20-year period. And if you want to change things, you simply change things. What we're going to see is this. In the capital markets, everything has to be pre-designed. Everything has to be locked in up front. So what we're going to find out is this. There's an enormous number of different types of notes and CP, mainly notes. There's maybe 100 different types of notes, and we'll go over all of this, NIFs and TRUFs and RIFs and all sorts of things. Why? Because what you basically do is you pre-lock in, you pre-design the conditions into the instrument, because once it's offered and it's sold in the market, you can't change it. With the loan facility, it's got enormous flexibility, and we can constantly change and revise that over the duration of the term, 20 years, for example. With capital markets, we have to tie everything in up front. So we have a whole series of different things, but we take all those decisions at the beginning, and then we sell them up front, then they're sold into the market. It's much more difficult to change and alter. I've mentioned the core obligations. We'll consider those in terms of the CPs, the reps and Ws, and the cuts. The issued procedure and syndication, you take the mandate letter. I explain the actual operation of this, how it's done in practice. Mandate letter generally will be conditional. It's conditional on final bank approval, and it's also exclusive. What you don't want to do is have the borrowers tendering or looking for lots of different banks, negotiating at different times. You want to try and tie the borrower in so you get an exclusive offer, and then it will be conditional on final bank approval. I explain all of this in further detail in the text. The term sheet outlines, summarises all the key provisions, mainly the core financials, but now what actually happens is the term sheet acts as a form of mini loan agreement. It basically uses the same index structure as the final loan agreement, and what will happen is the investment banker, the lead banker, will just go through, check, is happy with everything. That will be discussed and agreed with the borrowers. And then the lawyers will approve everything, make sure everything works. And then reflect all of the core provisions set out in the term sheet. As the legal draftsman, you will ensure those are then reflected in the final loan document. That's basically your instruction. The term sheet sets out all of the key terms. It will also highlight standard R's and P's, standard CP's, reps and W's, CUVs, anything you need to look at. So you just check down the term sheet, make sure that the standard document that you're preparing reflects those. And once those two correspond, you can circulate that as the first draft. The information memorandum sets out all of the core business details for the borrowers, their background, their history, their origin, their general areas of operation, their business condition, financial condition, and their business prospects, including how they're going to repay this. The banks use this to determine whether they want to participate in the facility. So this essentially supports the individual bank credit assessment which is taken. In practice, all of this will be effectively done by the lead bank, and it will agree the amount and the interest, but then that will have to be discussed and agreed with the participant banks as a whole. So in practice and legally and commercially, each bank's taking its own decision, although a lot of this will be sort of like predetermined, but then agreed to afterwards. But the banks are relying on the information provided here because there won't be any other sources of information apart from publicly made available information. So this supports the individual credit assessment each bank makes. I then summarise the loan procedure, how this will actually operate in practice. If you're working in a big law firm involved with this, it's very interesting, it's very exciting, it's very important, and it's very, very rewarding work. All we'll find out is this: when you go into the capital markets and you're doing the bonds and the notes and the CP, it's just much faster, much, much faster. You're sitting in your office and you'd rather get a telephone call from one of the partners, the senior partner, or you get an email, we're setting up a big 100 million facility or a 100 million bond issue. Can you be at the lead bank's office in Liverpool Street tomorrow morning for a breakfast meeting? And it just takes off. And it's very exciting and it's very rewarding. You will enjoy. So, all the basic procedures, all the basic exchanges, in terms of mandate letters and the fee quotes and the exchanges. There's some extra things in there which I haven't gone into in any detail. For example, you do no conflict checks. Whenever you take instruction, you're about to enter into any big deal, you need to get a no conflict check, which means firms do it. You need to make sure there's no conflicts of interest in the firm with one partner or member of staff acting on behalf of the client in a different capacity or in a conflicting capacity. That's the only thing I think that's missing here. Yeah, we'll always begin this with no conflict checks, but then I've explained all of the sort of the daily operation procedures, how we get from initial instruction to the actual closing and the signing. Remember, the closing and signing just means that everything comes into effect legally. The borrowers don't actually have to draw down. The drawdown will be provided for separately in the documentation. They will submit a drawdown letter under the LME language. It's called the utilisation request. And we'll see how all of this works. three key sets of fees. Basically, the lead bank, the managing bank, will get a percentage cut of the deal, possibly up to 50 basis points, maybe more. The members, the syndicate members, will charge for just making the facility available. There is no point in setting up a 100 billion facility if it's not going to be used. Once it's drawn down, they will charge the IBOR plus the margin and then any other payments which have to be made. Until it's drawn down, there's going to be a commitment or a syndication fee, typically 0.75. Oh, that actually seems quite high, but that's maybe typical. And then the agent bank, who undertakes the administrative function of actually managing the loan once the loan agreement's entered into, they will get a separate fee, but this will be much, 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 much lower. Much lower. The lead bank, the arranging bank, takes a very high fee up front and then leaves on the closing. And we'll see that in the documentation. The standard documents will provide that the lead bank, agent bank, knows no duties and has no obligations of any form to anybody, to any parties whatsoever, before and after the agreement comes into effect. Even if the lead bank is a syndicate member, it can actually transfer on its obligations to lend before the closing, and this often happens in practice. It is possible, nevertheless, for the lead bank and the agent bank to be the same group, the same banking group. So it may well be that the London office is running the lead bank facilities, setting up the loan, setting up the syndicated participation, setting up all these facilities, but then it may be like another branch or another subsidiary or another operation, another regional branch somewhere in Scotland or north of England is doing the administrative bank function. There is no reason why it can't be the same bank. But it will be two completely different divisions receiving completely different amounts of money. The lead bank receives a very small amount of money, the agent bank receives a very small amount, the lead bank receives a very large amount. But again, that's why we have to manage the liability, just to make sure that if anything goes wrong, the syndicate members, if they can't sue the borrower and they can't sue each other, who are they going to sue? They've only got the lead bank and the arranging bank left. The syndication, I've summarised all this in the table, all of the key points we've made before, I just expand in detail. So, severality provisions identify all of the key clauses, explain how this works in practice. Proportionality, equality, democracy, and then limited delegation of function, that then corresponds with the specific duties and mandate responsibilities of the agent bank, so we can then discuss that in terms of receipt duties, payment duties, banking duties, and notification and default duties. There was an important point on just negotiation in footnote 50. So let's just go back to footnote 50. What we need to do is this. During the negotiations, we need to make sure that everything is subject to contract. This is important. In practice, you need to watch this. There's key case law on this. Let me just enlarge. We'll see there, Edward Skyways, 1964, 1WLR. We always specify that draft documents are subject to contract so that they're only ever drafted and don't create legal effect before we've actually signed them, authorised and executed them and a final approval. Famous case, Edward Skyways, is to reverse this presumption of legal intent. That can happen in a number of cases very easily, even when we don't expect it. So, for example, we'll see here, a contract can still be created even where all of the terms are not agreed or formalised, with documentation to be entered into subsequently. That was Brancana versus Cabara, Branca versus Cabara, and the anemone. This also arises where non-essential terms are left for future negotiation, Pagnam SPA. So this is important stuff. You always specify subject to contract. And any emails and any documentation you're passing around, always subject to contract to reverse this presumption of legal intent. What we'll then see is this. There's a number of other important cases which become relevant when we look at the specific obligations that we're now considering in further detail. We'll come back and look at lead bank and agent bank liability separately. About specific paper which examines all of this. We mentioned some of the misrepresentation points before, some of the other key points are highlighted here. In terms of the loans and obligations, what we have is this. We have the conditions precedent, we have the representations and warranties, and the covenants, the CUFs, the CPs, the reps and W, and the CUFs. Now, it would appear, we would assume that the CPs are pre-loan agreement, the reps and W's are pre-advance, and the CUFs are post-advance. Legally, that's not actually correct. Because when we look at the drafting, the CPs are technically post-advance, post-drawdown. The reps and W's are pre-loan agreement, and the CUFs are post-drawdown. So, although legally and commercially, we always discuss these in terms of the CPs, the reps and W's and the CUFs, it's actually the reps and W's, the CUFs, the CPs and the CUFs. So we just need to watch that. And again, what happens in practice is this. Although a lot of the key clauses seem to do one thing, it will then possibly be contradicted or slightly adjusted or corrected by another clause. So again, we have, for example, we have repeaters and we have evergreens. So some provisions repeat every time there's a drawdown. Or we have evergreens, which means they apply at all times. So we need to watch repeaters and evergreens as well, and we need to watch the relationship between these different provisions. Now, what I've done is, in the text and then more detail in the footnote, I expand on the nature of these different types of obligations. So what we're essentially looking at are the CPs, the reps and the CUFs. There's some interesting issues as to the legal effect of, for example, the CPs. If the CPs aren't satisfied, or before they're satisfied, can the banks withdraw? There's some nice, interesting case law here. What are the duties and obligations of the party? So I've expanded that in the text, in particular, footnote 170. What I've also done in footnote 171 is explain the legal nature of each of these different terms. So a representation is a statement of fact rather than opinion or law. Leaf versus International Galleries. A warranty is an undertaking or promise. So we're representing and warranting. So we're making statements of fact and we're undertaking certain, we're making certain promises and undertakings. The legal effect of this, I expand in further detail in this footnote here. The point simply is this. A representation is not as strong as a warranty. So we're going to represent and warrant to elevate the representations to the warranties. But even then, the representations and warranties are still not conditions. They're still not actual obligations within the contract. So therefore, our only remedy still is damages, when the remedy the banks want is rescission. They don't need to rescind, but with rescission, they can then negotiate in a much stronger position in dealing with the group if it comes to any form of renegotiation or restructuring. So I deal with that in the text, and I've given you a number of core cases there. In practice, the way we deal with this is that. We're going to elevate the reps to the W's and the reps and W's to the CUFs. The way we do it most simply is just tie it into the events of default. We make it an express event of default that if you breach the reps, the W's or the CUFs, we can call rescission. So that's how we can reconcile this in practice, by basically pulling this together to make sure that all of this fits in a way that gives us the legal effect that the banks want, that our clients want. In the event of default, what are the five consequences of default? If we look at the LMA documentation, it only seems to appear to suggest one, two, or three. In my opinion, there's five effects of default, which are on the separate table I've given you already. Suspension. We suspend further drawdown, we suspend further advance. Secondly, cancellation. We cancel further drawdown, further advance, if there's a default. If there's a default, what are the implications of that in law? So, suspension, cancellation, and then acceleration. Thirdly, we accelerate repayment. We've already drawn down a certain amount, 10 million, 12 million, whatever, we accelerate that repayment. Fourthly, we can rescind. We can rescind the contract, and then finally, fifthly, we can enforce. We can sue under the contract. Now, strictly speaking, we don't need to rescind anyway. If we rescind, the contract's then of no legal effect, so we can't enforce it. There will be rights in this contract we want to be able to enforce. Now, strictly speaking, it doesn't matter because if something's occurred, our right to exercise specific clauses and protections will apply from that time anyway. So it's the threat of rescission that's powerful. But we don't actually need to rescind because we still want to exercise different clauses and different protections. Although in practice, it doesn't really matter when we rescind. So long as we have the power to rescind, that's what gives the banks the negotiating power to restructure and to re-agree suitable terms so that they can protect their relative interests. So, I've explained this, I've incorporated key case law, and I've also referred to the court drafting the key provisions in the Loan Market Association documentation. The conditions precedent themselves, these generally are documentation-based or certification or other consents and licensing-based. We want to provide constitutional documentation, sovereign confirmations, details with regards to any security. A typical syndicated loan agreement is unsecured, although for specific purposes it may be secured. We will take legal opinions to ensure that this is enforceable in every country that's relevant to the nature of the facility, including if there's security. So if there's security in different parts of the world, we'll need legal opinions to make sure that security is enforceable. And that will include things like rights of set-off, liens, charges, all sorts of other things as well. Any other confirmations that we'll specify, and then we also have conditions subsequent. These are the conditions precedent, CPs, but we also have CS's conditions subsequent. We may want other documentation to be provided afterwards. But this is where things also begin to overlap, and you need to watch this. You've got the CPs, the documents generally. You've got the reps and Ws, which are confirming the validity of the documents and undertaking to do certain things. But you've also got the continuing cuffs. There's actually quite a lot of overlap between them. So again, you need to watch this. And when you need to sit with your documentation, as you're reading and you're thinking and you're absorbing this, see how it all fits together. And some of it's not perfectly congruous. It's not always symmetric. As I said before, we have like conditions subsequent rather than precedent, and we have evergreens and we have repeaters and we have various other clauses which can slightly don't quite work in the sort of a simple basic coherent structure that we might expect. So it's a bit more complex, it's a bit more dynamic than may otherwise appear. The reps and W's, we're going to have legal warranties, and then we're going to have financial or commercial warranties, basically confirming the validity of certain things. Essentially repeating that the documentation provided is legal and valid and that certain conditions are correct. The borrower has power to do this. This is not illegal. Various other consents have been obtained. So we need to look at the reps and the W's. As we've said already, although it looks like the reps and W's are in the middle, which means post-loan agreement but pre-advance, in practice, if you read them carefully, they're actually reps and W's are pre-loan agreement. It's the CPs which are pre-advanced. Each time you're drawing down, you're going to each of the borrowers is going to draw down during the availability period for the facility A or the revolver period. You repeat, you confirm everything that's in the CPs. And then we have the covenants. These are the continuing obligations. These are possibly the most important, although they're all important in practice. We have corporate cuffs and we have the financial cuffs. The corporate cuffs and the financial cuffs tie back in with the financial reps and W's. That's principally determined with regards to these ratios. And we'll look at that in further detail. I will give you a list of all of the different types of ratios that can come up. In practice, for a simple syndicated loan, it can be quite simple. There might be just be two or three quite basic financial ratios. If it's a more complex deal, including a project finance deal, you could have 10 of them, 20 of them. And we'll see all the different types that could come up. Liquidity ratios, leverage ratios, activity ratios, probability ratios, market ratios. And then we're going to use various testing assessment approaches, net present value, NPV, internal rate of return, the IRR, the modified IRR, the MIR. And then we'll have other forms of analysis to support these, sensitivity analysis, scenario analysis, Monte Carlo. So I'll give you some additional information on this so we can understand all this. As a lawyer, you're not advising on this, but this will have been in the term sheet, so you need to make sure it's reflected in the final loan documentation, and when you're discussing this with the lead bank and with your clients, the lead bank probably is your client, but the lead bank's discussing it with the borrowers, their clients, you need to be able to understand all of this and discuss all of this and explain all of this. You will never have to do the actual calculations, that's for the accountants, but the more articulate and intelligent you are, the more effective you will be in these negotiations. Then disposals, then the key corporates are the negative pledge. We're going to basically prohibit the borrower from issuing any other security which grants priority over our position. We're going to have a pari passu clause. All unsecured obligations are treated equally. We're going to control the disposal so they can't make any material disposals which would undermine our ability to recover and execute. And then we have other general undertakings as well. The loan default, I've discussed default and then explained all of the key provisions which are incorporated. Most of these are obvious: non-payment, breach of financial covenants, non-financial breach, misrepresentation. Then we have insolvency, other creditor process, similar to insolvency, other loss of control, illegality, repudiation. The two key clauses to watch are the cross-default clause and the MAC clause. We'll spend more time negotiating these than anything else. The default positions, effects I've already mentioned: suspension, cancellation, acceleration, rescission and enforcement. And then look at transfers. I explain the nature of each of these in further detail. Assignment, legal and equitable. I explain all of the conditions within the Law of Property Act 1925, section 136, the implications of this, how we can lose priority in practice, what we have to watch out for when we're advising our clients on this. If we only want to transfer benefits and rights, we can assign. If we want to transfer obligations, we have to novi. We're cancelling the original obligation, entering into a replacement obligation. Participation, sub-participation, blind participation. If there's any element of risk or a contingent element, we call it a risk participation. Securitization and trust is all explained in the text. And then we have loan restructuring. I talk about loan rescheduling, London and Paris clubs, and then IMF and World Bank involvement. Everything that we need to understand in connection with structure and operation of these important key, possibly the most important single international financial market. This is how governments and the largest companies in the world operate. Without these, they couldn't. Governments could not function without these markets. All of this is dealt with in the paper that you have on the system.